Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Because mindfulness is like existential honesty. Like, what is really happening? What's happening in my mind? What am I experiencing? Okay, what's a wise way to respond to that? And love is always a wise way to respond to everything that appears.
Hey, everybody, it's Raw going back with Mind Rolling, and I have a lovely new guest today, Kevin Griffin. Welcome to Mind Rolling, Kev.
Thanks, Raghu. Thank you so much for having me.
And so he has a wonderful book called Living Kindness. And, you know, I think going back as far, a couple of decades ago, I don't know, whenever His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, there was, it's a bumper sticker, but it meant so much, which was, kindness is my only religion.
Yes, and yes. That's a great line.
Yeah, more than once, many, many times. And so that just struck me, Kevin, to go, okay, yes. And in fact, many's a time I myself and some of my cohorts from back in the day, Krishna Dass being one of them, if you know who he is.
Sure.
And people, you know, they're first getting on the path, and it's okay. We're Westerners. What's the goal? We're going to get enlightened.
Right.
I don't know how many times either one of us or both of us have said, let's try for more loving, more kind, more compassionate. Let's try that. Not worry so much about the rest of it. But can you, I just want to hear about your journey to step on that path. And, you know, because we all came from a very conditioned atmosphere, childhood, society, all. And right now, it's of course, I can't imagine how children are growing up through this, but we can talk about that a little later. What was your journey?
Well, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, probably like you. And so as a musician, you know, the music is this, you know, complicated thing in our culture because it has this spiritual side. But, you know, rock and roll was always associated with this more decadent lifestyle. And I was kind of pulled in both directions. You know, I wanted to meditate. And I wanted
How did you even get there? How did you even know there was a thing called meditation?
Well, it's the Beatles, of course. Right. And, you know, George Harrison and the Maharishi. I kind of got distracted, so it took me a decade or so. It was the late 70s when I finally learned TM. Mm. And then a couple of years after that, got into Buddhist meditation. And that was a real time of searching. So, you know, there wasn't really this sense of like Buddhism and Hinduism. It was all sort of like blending together. And so I would go and see every guru who came to town. I was living in LA in those days. Mm. And there was a lot of, I would say, wandering, you know, some of which was productive. You know, I mean, well, productive isn't quite the right word, right? Some of it led to more helpful places, and some of it led to less helpful places. You know, following one sort of guru who sort of took me off the path in a way. I got sober in 1985, and things started to clear up a little bit in my brain and in my meditation and my path. And eventually, you know, and the 12 steps are this spiritual journey, but they're not Buddhist. Explicitly, they aren't. Maybe implicitly, they are. And so, but eventually, I kind of started in my own life, started to merge those two things and started to, you know, develop this kind of Buddhist recovery path. And and that sort of created something that was more holistic, because I think, as you talked about, I don't know if we were recording then, but about enlightenment, and I had these sort of lofty ideas about enlightenment that weren't very grounded and didn't really allow for either a wholesome life or even like a comfortable life, really, because, you know, I was a starving musician most of the time. And so sort of getting my life together in practical ways actually allowed my meditation and my spiritual practice to flower as well, I think. And, you know, it's mysterious how it all unfolds, isn't it? You know, it's hard to really kind of go back and say this caused that and that caused that. All I know is that things started to make sense in a way for me, and my life seemed to come together, I guess, in the mid-late 90s. I had gone back to school and got into writing, and then I was invited to start teaching. I don't know if you know Wes Nisker.
Yes, I know Wes.
So Scoop, he's a dear friend of mine. I just went to visit him this morning, and we had a big event for him at Spirit Rock on Sunday, celebrating his 80th birthday. I got to play some music with him there. And he was really kind of mentored me to extend, invited me to start to teach to his group in Berkeley when he was away teaching retreats. And so, you know, there is also something about when you start to teach the Dharma, it takes on more of an urgency. Your own practice takes on an urgency, right? Because now it's not just about you. Mm. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm going to get enlightened. It's like, oh, I need to help people. And mm-hmm. I need to be able to actually make sense, like be able to explain something. There were a lot of things like I thought I knew. But then when I was like, okay, I'll give a talk on the Noble Eightfold Path. And I was like, oh, wait, what's on the, there's mindfulness, what? I better go look it up, you know? So that kind of study and the sense of my practice being for more than me brought it very much alive. And then eventually I wrote a book about Buddhism and the 12 steps. And that gave me kind of a, I don't know, an audience for sure. This is the first book I've published. Living Kindness is the first book I've published that wasn't about recovery explicitly. Oh.
You know, it's talking about 12 step. It's amazing how many people get an initial transformation through this 12 step program.
Yeah.
I just actually did a podcast with someone who's also eventually turned to Tibetan Buddhism, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But he came very close to not making it through. I mean, mm-hmm. ended up really, you know, the whole classic story of drugs and on, you know, down on Skid Row in LA and coming from, you know, a middle-class family, you know, it doesn't matter, really. Right. I mean, he had trauma, and that trauma did him in. You know, he had a traumatic event in his life, and that trauma did him in. And then he actually, you know, they go around, and they're the people who care and have organizations that care to try and help homeless people and so on, and they picked him up, and he was half-naked, out of it, and that's where he went. Aside from cleaning him up and giving him some food and so on, they took him to 12 step.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that absolutely shook his foundation and allowed him to make a fairly quick make a move to have the intent to transform and to change this horrible environment that he had created for himself. Yeah, it's a 12 step. I mean, and I'm not that familiar with it, except through people and their stories like this and what you're saying.
Yeah, it's a really interesting process. I mean, when I first engaged in it, I took it very literally, just kind of went through it. And I was saying, even though I'm not really theistic, I'm also not atheistic. I'm not sure what's in between, but I followed it, but there was always this piece, the 11th step suggests that you meditate, right? And I was already a meditator, and I would go to a meeting where everybody would say, okay, we're going to meditate for 5 minutes. And I'd be like, 5 minutes? Okay, well, I'm used to going on like 10-day retreats, but okay, 5 minutes. And then the rest of the meeting, everybody would talk about how hard it was to meditate for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think there's might be an opening here for me. And that's one of the things that draws people to my work, as well as the fact that I'm suggesting that the Dharma can be your higher power rather than praying to some sort of Abrahamic God, you know, power, but the Dharma itself is powerful and provides all you need for turning your will and your life over to the Dharma.
You know, I'm not sure how much you do know about our legacy of Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's guru.
I'm pretty familiar, yeah.
Yeah. So what it ended up, you know, and I've talked about this quite a bit, and it's represented most strongly by the years that Ram Dass was in Maui, and we held these retreats a couple of times a year there, and always they were accompanied, he and Krishnadas basically were accompanied by many of our mutual Buddhist friends who have been friends with us and with Ram Dass for a long time. And it really, so we've started to, you know, look at this and say, okay, what does this really represent here? You know, because we're talking about, talk about theistic. We were introduced to a monkey god, okay?
Right, of course.
And Christ, you know, which a lot of us were Jewish, so that was also like, what, really?
Christ. Right, yeah.
So, you know, that legacy included also us somehow, without, he never said to do anything. Nothing, meditate, nothing. He'd have fun with it. It was mostly felt like he was sending us just to get rid of us because we were pesky little hippies. Mm-hmm. So, but we all ended up doing Vipassana meditation, which is where we met Jack, Joseph, Sharon, you know, all of the other people, by the way, that are on Be Here Now Network that you can take advantage of. And so that combination of, this is how it feels to me, of just the heart that Ram Dass most significantly addressed, you know, with, and at the end of his life, it was all about loving awareness, of moving into a place where you're not caught in your story and your thoughts and all of it, and moving into that place which is beyond judgment, which is an expanded place that has some, as the Buddhists would call it, relative connection to empty of me land. And so that combination, I think, I'm happy to be part of it, and it's done, you know, it's been extraordinary for me in these last decades, but I think to share that with people, that combination, anyhow,
Well, and you know, it's often been sort of observed that just doing strict Vipassana meditation kind of has this dry quality to it. At a certain point, you kind of get to a place where it's like, okay, everything is empty. And the heart piece is really what completes it. Yeah. I mean, for me, Miracle of Love was a book that really just opened me so much. Just the simple stories and it, you know, it's stepping out of your, you know, Western scientific mechanical kind of mind and stepping into that mystery. I mean, Neem Karoli Baba really embodied that and just like invited you in. It felt like from just the reading that I've done about him and the stories I've heard. And, and that was always really important for me. That, you know, I needed to have that place. It's a refuge, right? The heart is a refuge from the mind in a way, you know, that sometimes we just really need to step out of all that stuff that's, you know, running through the mind. Just remember, to love myself, to love others, to love this breath, to love this, you know, dog that's barking on the next door neighbor, and just... drop all that noise and story.
So, and the book is full, very fulfilling, very filling with the heart, I must say, and of course related around metta, loving kindness practice, which I am very familiar with because being close to Sharon Salzberg for many, many years. She is the most famous proponent of this practice in the West. But then you start off this chapter, one, May I Be Happy, subtitle Loving Yourself. So for me, it just triggered this thing. Like the first spiritual guru type that I ever encountered was Meher Baba. I'm not sure. You know Meher Baba? And it was nothing but a poster somebody put up with that beautiful poster. Smiling face. Don't worry, be happy. Okay, where do I sign up for this? This is exactly, so this just triggered May I Be Happy. And you know, I like how you talk about, I don't like myself any more than any other people like themselves. Right. But the one thing to remember is I do know myself better than most other people, almost right. everyone else.
Right.
In my own experience, the only person who knew me better was Neem Karoli Papa.
Mm, right.
And you could see that with many people, which is really a wild thing to consider. But the first that indicates like knowing we know ourselves, and yeah. to me, mindfulness is such an important method. It's also overused and maxed out, and it's right. like we're all going to become better, stockbrokers because we're right. going to be more mind. It's all that, but that's mm-hmm. the West. That's us so, humans. That's how we yeah. deal with stuff.
Yeah.
But the reality, as the Buddha put it, all those many years ago, the way in which we can address the, as you put it, impatience, irritability, prejudices, delusions, moodiness, self-centeredness. I mean, we could go on and mm-hmm. how about really awful motivations and manipulations and so on. So certainly, maybe you can talk about, for people, we have a lot of listeners here that understand and know about the teachings of Buddha, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and have some basic understanding. Or some people just get the idea of what the Buddha represented, just yeah. him. But I always like to share the things that can help get our lives a little bit more in balance, just get to that place without having extensive knowledge of right. the intricate teachings that Buddhism does represent. Yeah. So mindfulness.
Yeah. So, I think what I was trying to do here was to convey the challenges of trying to do this, because, when you put out an idea of, love everybody, sometimes I can feel that, on my good days. But what about when I'm not feeling it or when I sit down and try to do love for myself and really kind of talk people through a little bit how to be a little bit more at ease with themselves because if we're going to love others, we need to start with ourselves. If we're just loving everybody else and not ourselves, that's like codependence. It's not really love. Mm-hmm. It's trying to get something from them. So, I take this kind of sideways approach, I guess. I mean, people accuse me of being negative sometimes, so I'm not the typical spiritual teacher, which is why I start out by, talking about my own challenges. But just as you're saying...
What do they mean, negative?
Because I don't... I don't... What do they mean? You'd have to ask them. That I'm not going to start out by saying, painting a rosy picture of myself or of human, I don't like the term human nature, but human habits. Mm-hmm. Try to be really honest about that and then work through it, which, as you say, mindfulness is the only way to get there, because mindfulness is like existential honesty. Like, what is really happening? What's happening in my mind? What am I experiencing? Okay, what's a wise way to respond to that? And love is always a wise way to respond to everything that appears. But what is, love has this frilly idea to it. So I actually now define love as care. So caring for myself, because love myself sounds like I have to like myself. Like, I'm a really good person. And teachers will say, I characterize this, but sometimes I'll hear people say, Think of one nice thing you did today, and right away, or you know, right away, all I can think about is all the bad things I did or yeah, bad thoughts. Right.
You know, as soon as you say that, yeah.
Instead, it's dark. I'm not going to try to like make myself feel good about myself, like myself, think, but rather just take care of myself. If I'm taking care of myself, I'm loving myself. If I take care of my child or my partner or my friends or the earth, that's love. So I guess the problem that I'm addressing to a great extent is the problem of love as a feeling versus love as an action. And so that's why the book is called Living Kindness, because acting out of love and is to me more meaningful than feeling it. You know, I can feel love for someone and it doesn't do them any good necessarily. And I can, maybe if I don't feel it, I want to still be able to express it, because sometimes my emotions are all, you know, feelings are impermanent. So I can't hold on to a feeling of love, you know, perpetually, but I can be devoted to actions of love. So, I mean, you know, on this, you know, because of your background, I think of the Seva Foundation, you know, it was like, oh, how can we help people in India? You know, well, gee, we could say prayers for them. Well, that's nice. That's great. But how about if we actually tried to help people who go blind? You know, how about if we actually tried to, you know, do service for them? You know, the Buddhist Global Relief that Bhikkhu Bodhi started, he was asked by his students, how can we help the world? And he didn't say, well, let's go out and teach everybody how to meditate. He said, the worst form of suffering is hunger. Let's try to serve people with food. So to me, this is the starting point, is living with kindness, acting, caring for ourselves, caring even when we don't feel it. Even when I'm really angry with my child, that I still take care of them, which is loving them.
So what was the name of that person you just mentioned who started that?
Bhikkhu Bodhi.
Bhikkhu Bodhi.
Oh yeah, Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's a Buddhist monk from Brooklyn, but he spent many years in Sri Lanka and translated a great many of the Buddhist texts, that the Pali Canon, and you know all the now insight teachers study the things that he translated, and he came back to the U.S. I think probably about 15 years ago. And, you know, he made this big pivot from being this scholar to being someone who was much more engaged in service in the world, and founded Buddhist Global Relief.
Wow.
He's quite a wonderful teacher. If you ever had a chance to interview him, he'd be a great, great person. I mean, of course, Joseph and Jack and Sharon are all, you know, devotees.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, someone who, more on the Zen side, Bernie Glassman, Roshi Bernie, did a lot of that action, taking action on the material plane to help people, you know.
Well, his street retreats sounded really amazing, where they would just go and live on the street in New York. Oh, you want to see what it's like to be a... You know, an alms mendicant? Okay, here you go.
Yeah, Ram Dass actually did a couple of those with Bernie. Uh-huh. They were good friends. So back to mindfulness, actually, because you said one word which to me is a byword for mindfulness. Without it, you're just bullshitting yourself.
Yeah.
And that's honesty.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the practice of mindfulness is the practice of look, you know, first of all, pause, breathe, slow down, and then look inside. And you can see the plethora of defilements and wrongheaded bullshit. And it's not easy to be honest. That's one of the things, actually. Obviously, everybody who listens to this podcast knows my past with Ram Dass and so on, but that was one of the most important things upon meeting him and then listening to him talk and all of that was self-honesty. And it made it available for us to do the one thing that you need to be honest. And it's Jack talks about it a lot, Jack Kornfield. And that is, it's okay to be human.
Right.
We're okay. We're going to screw up. It's okay. That allows more honesty, would you agree, to creep into the practice?
So it's so important. I got that from Ram Dass as well, you know, when I read him and saw him speak and listen to him, his humanity and just being okay with being himself out front about it really was important for me. And that's something that I consider vital as a teacher. It's beautiful when a teacher is enlightened and they can inspire you with their presence and just being such a sort of lofty being. But sometimes it can feel inaccessible. And there've been times when I've been around teachers that they didn't do it to me. I did it to myself, that I compared myself to them and then felt less than, you know, and because that's one model of teaching Buddhism is that you're supposed to get up there and be a Buddha or be a representative of the Buddha. Mm. And that's kind of, I think, a traditional Asian model maybe, but for me, that was always really hard. I mean, I would get very inspired, but I would also, there'd a little bit, you know, I'd kind of walk away feeling like, well, I'll never be as good as them. Mm-hmm. So that willingness to be honest, and frankly, where I learned that for myself, where I developed that capacity was in AA meetings.
Really?
Because in AA, you know, you have to be honest, but I discovered how freeing it was to be able to talk about my failings or my mistakes or my confusion in front of a group of people who were supportive and understood and cared and got it because they too were human. But, you know, particularly, you know, addicts and alcoholics were especially human, you know, especially flawed and have, you know, typically a history that can be pretty painful and shameful. And then to be able to share it, and just realize, oh, you know, it's just human. It's just human. And really, addicts are, you know, no different from anyone else. It's just that, you know, they had a problem that they needed that particular support. But you realize that just not having to protect yourself, this is like about ego, right? And then you realize, oh, this is the whole thing about the story and being caught in your own, you know, don't let anybody know this about me. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're in a box and you can get into a spiritual box, right? It's a very, you know, sometimes you go to spiritual groups and everybody's walking around being so holy that you can start to feel like, I don't know. Are these people real? You know, maybe I'm being hard on people, but
no, not at all.
you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, it's endemic again to our culture.
And
being human, and our proclivities are as such. I think the few things that just came through here around honesty and mindfulness, you know, are extremely important for people. And what about, you know, in the book, at different points in the book, you like will mention Buddha's direct teaching from the Satipatthana Sutras or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you'll say, well, this might be a little bit of a reach here, given our contemporary society, that maybe I'll put it a little different, you know, which I really did appreciate, because I do think you know, that we can set up an impossible reach by virtue of we are in a completely different era. We are a completely different society. These things need to be, shall we say, transformed for where we are, who we are now.
Yeah.
Speak to that, because you did in the book.
Yeah. Well, I'm a great, I'll say, fan of the suttas, the early Buddhist, earliest that we know of Buddhist teachings. And, you know, they are, I mean, they're very profound, but at times they are very lofty, and you
and
they're spoken to often to monastics as well. And we also know, like, they were in a language that's, we don't, you know, it's a dead language, so we don't really know exactly what he meant at times. So you're kind of faced with this question, am I going to try to just get the, what does this literally mean? Or am I going to try to, you know, bring into something that makes more sense for me? Well, obviously I want it to make sense for me, but there's always that risk of, oh, I'm just going to kind of smooth out the edges so that it feels good to me. So we have to be very careful how we approach this, I think, that we're, on the one hand, we're not just being kind of rigid and following some literal translation, but also that we're not drifting too far away from it. So, I mean, this is why, of course, for any of it to be meaningful, we have to have our own meditation practice, so that really what I think we're trying to do is compare our inner experience to the words that we're hearing from the Buddha, and then try to make some sense of that. And of course, the big problem with that is that there are no words that can actually express our inner experience. It's always from a distance. So, and then the Buddha, on top of this, the Buddha was probably, you know, one of the best meditators in human history. So when he talks about the mind, I'm not sure, like, if I can get to where he's talking about, even if I knew exactly what he was saying. Mm-hmm. So all of that creates this tension, I think. And I'm always in this, I always find myself in this place where I don't want to beat myself up for not being a good enough meditator or not living up to the Buddha's, you know, instruction. But I also don't want to just kind of be slipshod about the whole thing and like, oh, this is good enough. So it's playing with this kind of tension, which is, you know, in Buddhist terms, about right effort, right? And always the question, if you're striving, well, then you're just creating more suffering. But if you're just sitting back, you know, hanging out, you're not really changing anything. So this is the dance, right, as a meditator. Yeah. And it requires mindfulness to pay attention in every moment. Like, what is the energy? What is the edge of my effort right now? Am I pushing too hard? Am I laying back too much? And so we're always in this dance.
Yeah.
And it's got to be informed by love. If there's love there, if you're, as you said, that, you know, Ram Dass's phrase, loving awareness, then we're safe, you know, because it's always going to be done with care and kindness.
I go back to motivation again, you know, because really with this practice, with some meditative practice, and of course, you and I would both suggest Vipassana as being the most efficacious one, and I've done a whole bunch of them. And it doesn't mean I do japa, which is the Hindu thing, using mantras with beads, you know, chanting. It's all meditation. You know, that's true as well. But the grounding that you get with a meditative practice and the ability to look inside clearly and honestly at these motivations, all the way down to, well, let's see, this morning, it's not really going too well. I'm so distracted, and these thoughts that you start to believe in, and then you hopefully, not hopefully, I do believe, and if people ask me, where did you get after all this decades of practice in it?
Right.
It's just not following that thought the way I quickly would have in the past.
Yeah.
Not having, having much more spaciousness around it, meaning I'm not going to take it that seriously, it's okay, and just go back to the breath. As Sharon has said a billion times, the beauty of the human incarnation is we can always go back, however lost we might get.
Yes.
So, yeah. So very, yeah, that's central guiding post of mindfulness for us on a day-to-day basis is tremendously important. And then you talk about something else that's dear to our hearts, in terms of our own. Well, this isn't any news. Actually, the Buddha, when he was asked by Ananda, maybe his closest person, monk, he talked about the three refuges. Refuge.
Yeah.
The refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Sangha. And the Buddha asked him what was the most important, and he said Sangha, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Buddha said that was so far and above the most important of the refuges. And in our own experience and how we were led into it when we went to India and met Neem Karoli Baba and Ram Dass and I and all the others who followed him back over there that second time, that got created immediately. And of course, Indian families, which Maharaji sent us to his closest devotees that lived nearby, and we spent so much time with them and viewing this sense of community, family, interconnectivity, all of it, that has just been a through line to what we do now, you know, in our retreats and our community gatherings and so on. And just let me quote you, the example of living together puts a particular clarity on the issue of how we get along with others. But the broader point is the question of how we blend, like in milk and water, with other people. Yeah, because you, for the way I see it is you have like-minded people, satsang, sangha, and you're able to interact with them and really let go of your defenses and find that place where we all are part of the one. Then you're taking it out into the world where it's not quite like-mindedness.
Right.
And I love the, how do we blend like milk and water with other people? This is a central question for anyone. As social beings, humans need and depend on interaction, yet preferences, tendencies, and habits of behavior can easily put us into conflict, a wild understatement right there.
Yeah.
In whatever social context we are operating, we need to find ways to harmonize or we will suffer. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting the different ways that the Buddha kind of approaches this question, but one of them is that, or this point, one of them is that the only way you're going to become exposed to the Dharma is through another person, whether it's written down or spoken. And so that's always the starting point of the path. Mm-hmm. And then he says, and if you are with people, as you're saying, like-minded people, then they're going to encourage you. You're all going to be encouraged to behave skillfully, to create good karma together. And you're going to talk about the Dharma. So, you know, this being conversations about the Dharma, as he said, you know, and you're going to hear the Dharma. And so it's this whole sort of building process, right, of community that creates all these circumstances for the awakening, you know, that comes out of that. And this is one of the problems that Buddhism in the West has faced, that we are an individualistic society. Mm. And so we have this idea of the heroic, you know, hermit living out in the mountains and, you know, taking care of them, you know, just becoming enlightened by themselves. And it's not how it is. I mean, the Buddha was in community almost his entire life. There was just that brief period when he went off and sat under the Bodhi tree when he was already ripe for enlightenment, and sat under the Bodhi tree, whether it was like 40 days or so many weeks or, you know, whatever, we don't know the exact time frame, but it wasn't years. It was at most months that he went off. And then he immediately came back to community. And then for the next 45 years, he was with the Sangha that just grew and grew and grew. So this idea, this very Western idea of, oh, we should pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. And I mean, my goodness, you know, it's just such an unhelpful idea. I mean, yeah. Talk about misery. Everybody gets their own little, you know, studio apartment and lives on their own and has their little, you know, frozen dinner for one. And, you know, and it's not life. It's not human.
I know. Look what we have done in the West, particularly. I mean, still, when I go to India, I was there last fall. I mean, it's the reality of the family there and the interconnectivity of people and how they act. I mean, it's just, it has not stopped. Yes, there's a lot of big time BS abuse that happens through Maharaji spent, he was completely against caste system, and he focused on that, you know.
Right.
So, but what we do here with individuality, which is to me, it's really a large part of the creation of the polarization that we're in right now.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was interesting. Last week, I was over at UC Berkeley, where they have a mindfulness club that I visit and teach from time to time. And it's really lovely because, you know, it's college students trying to learn mindfulness. You know, we don't have enough of that. But there was a student who was visiting from Hong Kong. And after the class, she was walking down the hall with me and chatting and asking me some questions. And I noticed that she was standing very close to me and like speaking. And then I remembered hearing that, in like China and Japan, people don't have the same sense of physical space because there's so many more people that, you know, there's just sort of like, it's okay to be upright. Whereas we're always kind of like, oh, give me my space, man. Like, leave me alone.
Oh, God.
It was very funny. You know, I was like, well, this is funny the way she's standing so close to me. And then I realized,
Oh, my. You just triggered a memory for me, which is not a pleasant one, but I'm going to share it because it really points. It's not the end of the world, but I went on a pilgrimage in India with, we had three mentors, and this particular mentor, his name was Casey Tiwari. We just actually put a film out, a documentary about him, because he was the most extraordinary we're talking about meditators. He went into no pulse, no breath, samadhi at the drop of a hat. It's just the inspiration. He just, like Ramakrishna kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, so he was assigned to take care of Maharaji said, you take care of the Westerners, the day before he left, before he died. So we went up on a pilgrimage, actually with my mother. It was a beautiful experience, up through the mountains, the Himalayas, to temples, an 8th century temple, you know, all of it. And we were staying somewhere in a government guest house. And my mother had a room, and I had gotten, he didn't know this, but I got three rooms. It was kind of, place was half empty. So we're sitting there and had dinner and meditated, whatever we were doing. And then I said, okay, we should go to bed. He said, oh, you sleep right here. I go, no, I have another room. I wanted my own room.
Right.
It was so embedded. And talk about it. It's, we're human. I still have regrets that I actually went. And this was a big room. There were big rooms. It wasn't like, you know, that I actually, you know, cop to that crazy Western thing of we have our own space.
Right.
And we're going to protect the shit out of that space.
Right.
Yeah. Anyhow, yeah.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the retreat centers, you know, one of the retreat centers I teach, they don't have, they have like three single rooms and all the rest is dorms. And boy, people want those singles.
Oh, yeah. We know all about it for our retreats as well.
Yeah.
Concomitant to the idea that, so we have mindfulness and we have community, both of which to me are basic practices that we really, it's advantageous to take part in, shall we say. And then you talk about basically, you call it the choice to be generous and kind. And this, to me, is the essence of, I think, what you're trying to put across in this book, using, of course, many of the Buddha's own words and explaining them out. But it's to be generous and kind, the choice to be attentive to others' needs. And I always quote Simone Weil, the most generous act that we can make is to give complete attention to another human being.
Yeah.
And the choice to be of service. While selfishness and rudeness don't necessarily break precepts, they might as well because they have the same effect, harming others. Mm-hmm. This is a very powerful, potent, it's just a couple of sentences. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that, Kevin. I just had to, certainly a big part of what our legacy is around service.
Yeah.
And Ram Dass did, you know, represented that in his life profoundly. And when the first moment that we got to Kenchi, where Neem Karoli Baba was, that was inimitable. Nobody, because I asked you about that, the bhikkhu you were talking about, Bodhi.
Bhikkhu Bodhi, yeah.
Yeah. And his thing about, let's feed people,
you know?
That was the first thing that happened when we went there.
Right.
Nobody left that temple without food.
Yeah.
Nobody, you know? And that persisted the whole time, you know, I was there, and for everybody over, you know, a three-year period. So service, it breaks you out of the self-centered me thing, which is endemic for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, I just recently heard His Holiness talk about through, you know, Dan Harris, who does that 10% habit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So he went and he saw His Holiness recently, I think.
I listened to those, yes.
Yeah, and you heard him talk about why selfishness.
Cake to the woman.
Well, that concept,
right,
though,
right, why selfishness.
Yeah. It's all about, as soon as you do that act of compassion, that act of giving, that act of, you stop thinking about yourself. So in that way, you are enhancing your life.
Yeah.
That's why it's why selfishness. You're, you know, you're doing this. You realize this is a two-way street. That whatever you're giving is coming back. It's like one circle, and so on. So, yeah. But
you know, it's a key element of 12-step work too. And
kind of, go back there. That's amazing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, what they say, the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others, and that's taken as not just carrying a message, but being of service. And yeah, because being of service is getting out of yourself. And what's your biggest problem is yourself. So any way you can get out of yourself. I mean, that's one of the reasons people like to escape, right? Is to get out of themselves. But and that's not always a constructive thing. But, you know, I had the, I remember in my early retreats that they would have signups to do service on the retreat to, you know, do dishes or chop vegetables or something. And I was like, oh man, why would I do that? Like, I want to be meditating. I don't want to be, you know, working in the kitchen. And, you know, and it was like so thick-headed. And then I was on one retreat where one of my teachers was sitting the retreat and I saw him doing dishes and I said, why is he doing the dishes? You know, and then I finally figured the next retreat I signed up and I was like, oh, this is like the most fun I had on the retreat was cleaning the toilet on the bath on the retreat. You know, it was like, oh, I got out of myself. Oh, I wasn't thinking about me. I wasn't trying to concentrate on my breath again. I was just, you know, doing something that was not about me. So it's very freeing. It doesn't have to be. I think sometimes people hear the term, you know, do service, and they think they have to join, you know, Doctors Without Borders or something, and they, you know, they have to do something heroic. And and again, it can be the simplest thing, you know, can be just the simplest gesture. And, well, and as you said, just being able to pay attention to someone is the greatest gift.
Well, one thing, we've talked about metta, loving kindness, and this is, as I said before, I believe a through line throughout the book. But since we're close to the end of our podcast, I wondered if you might lead us in a, you know, just a few minute metta meditation.
Yeah, would love to.
Okay.
Thank you. Wherever you are, if you can, close your eyes. But if you're listening to this in your car, please keep your eyes open. And just feeling your breath in your heart, sense of your heart opening and softening. One of the simplest and most beautiful instructions the Buddha gives is that we should radiate kindness over the entire world. So one image to play with is that there's a golden beam of light that radiates out from your heart, the light of loving kindness. So imagine yourself first being filled with this light. Bright, warm, caring, filled with loving kindness. And then this light, this golden beam of light from your heart, spreads out throughout your home, out into your neighborhood or wherever you are. If you're driving, you can imagine the loving kindness spreading to all the other drivers, all going somewhere. And we radiate loving kindness out to all beings, humans, animals, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away. Says the Buddha, loving kindness radiating across the planet, through the oceans, across the land, touching all beings everywhere, all beings filled with the golden light of loving kindness. Finally, seeing the entire planet illuminated with the golden light of loving kindness. The planet itself healed. We care for our own planet, loving the planet itself. And may all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be filled with loving kindness. All right.
But Kevin, in the book, I just want to close with what you say is one of the most revered quotations, shloka, shall we say, in the Pali canon. And here it is. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings.
Yeah, my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, everybody can relate to that.
Yeah.
In fact, I tell the story, first meeting Ram Dass, and there was no Ram Dass, there was no Richard. He was able to just set up a beautiful space within which was tremendous trust and unconditionality. Mm-hmm. And only my mother, my only other experience of the up to that point was my mother. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and what His Holiness says, our whole future is based on compassionate mothers who transfer that into their children, who will go out and help transform this world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this beautiful. Is a wonderful thing. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Kevin, and we're going to have links in the show notes. People can get the book. And what's the other book called around the combination of 12-step and Buddhism?
One Breath at a Time is my That's my first book, my most popular one, Yeah,
One Breath at a Time. And everybody, you'll be able to hook up with what Kevin does. I know you're on the Bay Area, it sounds
yes,
like.
Yes, I am. And I'm on Zoom. I have Zoom classes regularly. Mm. My website is just kevingriffin.net, so people can easily find me.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, we'll have all of that available to people. So again, thank you very much. This is...
thank you for having me. It was really great to talk with you.
Yeah, same here. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and catch all of Kevin and my buddies, basically, all of our wonderful community, from Jack Kornfield to Sharon Salzberg to Roshi Joan Halifax and on, Krishnadas, Ram Dass, Alan Watts, the OGs, Ram Dass right. and Alan Watts, the OGs. And we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Thank you, Ken.
Yeah, thanks so much.